Saturday, July 28th, KPFA, in partnership with the New Parkway Theater in Oakland, present our inaugural movie matinee, All the President's Men. All the President's Men stars Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman as the Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who uncover the Watergate scandal. This film is the story of a story of two reporters covering a suspicious third-rate burglary and following it all the way to the White House. All the President's Men is as smart and as cautionary today as it was in 1976.
Nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment of the Constitution, freedom of the press, and maybe the future of the country.
Join us Saturday, July 28th at 3 p.m. at the New Parkway Theater, 474 24th Street between Telegraph and Broadway in Oakland, for All the President's Men, an intelligent and provocative film about our nation's political failing. This is a KPFA benefit. Information for tickets is online at kpfa.org.
It is just after 7:34 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas. We are beginning our third day into a deep investigation into Donald Trump's nominee for Supreme Court Justice of the United States, Judge Brett Kavanaugh. On Tuesday, we took a generalist approach looking at his broad record of judicial outlook. Yesterday, we looked into his approach to climate and the environment, which revealed a powerful anti-deregulatory and pro-industry record. Today, we're looking at a woman's right to choose and women's health. Our guest today is Elise Hoag, president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America, a national organization with 1.2 million members. The first thing you see when you go to NARAL's website today is a banner which reads, "Breaking, Trump nominates anti-choice ideologue Brett Kavanaugh as the next Supreme Court justice, ready to end Roe v. Wade." Thank you for joining us today, Elise Hoag.
Hello, Antonia. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So let's just start right there. How did NARAL come to this determination about Judge Kavanaugh, and what does it mean?
Well, we came to the determination before Kavanaugh was named because Donald Trump is the first major party nominee, especially one who's gone on to be president, to put a litmus test on Supreme Court justices. He said very publicly and proudly that he would only appoint justices that would overturn Roe, criminalize abortion, and punish women, and we take him at his word. However, I will say that his nomination of Brett Kavanaugh only underscores that is his intention. And you know, we think that this is a very dicey time. Kavanaugh himself had split from his circuit court last year when the Trump administration was holding a young undocumented woman against her will to prevent her from getting an abortion. The D.C. Circuit Court ordered her release, and Justice Kavanaugh dissented and said, keep her jailed. Don't let her get the abortion. He's also split with his circuit court around the ability of women who work for employers who oppose contraception to be able to get that contraception. So it would have been enough just to know that anyone on Donald Trump's list was committed to overturning Roe, because that is what they were vetted for, but Kavanaugh's record speaks for itself.
Can you speak more to the issue of vetting and, you know, how judges got on to Trump's list, and how you think we got to this nominee?
I mean, yeah, I can speculate about mm-hmm. how we got to this nominee, but I can certainly tell you that we know that the Heritage Society and Leonard Leo personally worked very, very closely with Trump to create this short list. I don't know how familiar your listeners are with the Heritage Society.
Maybe say a little bit about them. Yeah.
Yeah, they are an ultra-conservative organization that has spent years cultivating judges in their ideology, and they are hostile to precedent. In fact, they wrote a whole paper after Neil Gorsuch was confirmed, talking about Roe as rotten precedent. But they're hostile to all things government related. So they're, they would just continue the work. These justices would continue the work of dismantling all of the regulatory structure that the government has put in place to protect the American people. And And they've been, you know, they've had their hands in at every single one of the justices that was on the short list, many of whom, by the way, have already been confirmed for lifetime appointments at circuit court. So we you know, before Justice Kennedy's retirement, we were deeply, deeply concerned about the overtaking of the judicial branch by Trump nominees who are going to be there for lifetime appointments. But nothing is so scary as the Supreme Court, for the obvious reason that you have no recourse once you're on the Supreme Court. So Heritage Society has been very, very involved there. Leonard Leo himself is extremely hostile to women's reproductive freedom. And how we got, you know, they started around after, right after Justice Kennedy's retirement. They definitely started floating several names off of that list, all of whom we thought were disqualified based on the fact that they were on the list as well as their record. You know, my understanding as what's been reported is that what really won Trump over in his meeting with Kavanaugh was Kavanaugh's deference to Trump. And I share the concern of many of my colleagues that between the reports of that meeting and, of course, his writings about how the president should be above the law, is not subject to the law of the land, should really send a shiver up anyone's spine who believes that the independence of the judicial branch is our last remaining check against the runaway excesses of this administration. So I think we're going to hear a lot more about that in the coming days. I think, you know, the combination, I said this on MSNBC the other night, the combination of Donald Trump's, what I said is, if Donald Trump's obsession with self-preservation and Mike Pence's obsession with controlling women had a love child, it would look a lot like Brett Kavanaugh.
We're speaking to Elise Hoge. She is president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Elise Hoge, I was wondering if you could help us with a quick bit of audio troubleshooting. It sounds like you switched over to a speakerphone and we're having trouble hearing you sometimes. Could you pick up your receiver for us?
How's that? Is that better?
Much better.
Thank
you.
That is amazing. I have a question for you. A lot of the discussion so far has centered on Roe v. Wade. And if Roe v. Wade got overturned by the Supreme Court, that would return to the status quo ante. It would mean states had the power to ban abortions. Many states would continue to preserve access to abortions. I can't imagine the anti-choice agenda steps there. How far are we from the courts creating rights for fetuses?
I mean, that's an excellent question, and certainly many states have already created rights for fetuses, some going so far as to have fetuses represented by their own lawyers in courts. But I want to back up for a minute. I do think it's really important that your listeners, who many of whom, I'm sure not all of whom, are in California, understand the reality of the rest of the country, because, you know, it is a very comfortable right-wing talking point that, oh, overturning Roe, all it does is return the power to the states. The vast majority of the states in this country have been taken over by a hostile anti-choice legislatures and governors. And so the reality is probably about 14 states would criminalize abortion overnight.
Well,
they have trigger laws that are already on the books. It would require no further action for that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, some are trigger laws and some are pre-Roe criminalization laws that just have not been enforced since Roe has been in place, but would be enforceable the minute that Roe falls, right? And only a handful of states actually have protections for abortion access, either through their state constitution or statutorily, many of which are on the left coast. You guys would become an island. But as a Texan myself, I can tell you that even with, you know, a state legislature hostile to abortion rights and reproductive freedom for women can do an enormous amount of damage, even with Roe in place, and they will go on overdrive if Roe is gutted or overturned. So I think that that's a really crucial reality for people to know. And then the other thing that I think is really crucial for people to know is you spoke about rights for fetuses, which is important, and I want to come back to that in a minute, but is, you know, I keep saying
this is actually not your anti-choice movement of the 60s and 70s. We're living in pretty mean and cruel times. And so there was, you know, an outcry a couple months ago when a columnist at the Atlantic magazine argued that women should be hanged for having abortions. And he was ultimately relieved of his post for refusing to back away from that position. But that's not theory, right? We have 20 state legislators in Ohio who are signed onto an existing bill that would mandate capital punishment for women who have abortions. We also have many laws on the books that would require a criminal investigation into miscarriages to make sure that, you know, women didn't self-induce abortion. We're talking about a very, very scary environment, which is already playing out in some states, mostly against poor women, mostly, you know, against women of color who have fewer resources to defend themselves. But we would see that scale up. Vis-a-vis the rights of fetuses, I think it's really, you know, one of the things that I remind people is, you know, our right to have abortions is enshrined in Roe. Roe is much bigger than that because the decision in Roe, as well as in Griswold, quite honestly, which granted married couples the right to use contraception, is really about a fundamental principle of who gets to decide the most intimate things about your life. Is it the government or is it you and your family? And the combination of rights for fetuses plus the privacy rights enshrined in Roe would put a whole host of things on the table. If the government can decide you can't have an abortion, the government could also decide that you have to have an abortion. The government could decide that there are people that should be forcibly sterilized, right? And we've actually lived through times like that in this country. We rejected them. I think that's why we see the numbers that we're seeing right now in polling, where a whopping 73% of self-identified independents that, you know, that's separate from Democrats, support the rights upheld in Roe. People are very, very frightened about this massive government overreach into controlling our lives, our bodies, and our future.
Talk more then about how you see Judge Kavanaugh as a potential threat to Roe v. Wade and what that might look like when and if he came onto the court.
Well, I mean, you know, I talked a little bit about his dissents in the circuit court, but Axios actually put a chart out yesterday morning they have some algorithm that weights the full extent of his judicial rulings, and it comes up with a coefficient, and that coefficient put Kavanaugh, if he was on the court, just a teeny, teeny, tiny bit to the left of Clarence Thomas and to the right of Neil Gorsuch, who is to the right of Alito, right? So what we're looking at then when you throw Roberts in is he, you know, a surefire bet to be hostile to not just Roe, but equality in all of its forms, including for women, but others as well. You know, our future is being decided by five men on the court, which is terrifying. How does that play out? I mean, starting in October, we've got cases wending their way through the courts that could begin the process of gutting Roe. And I think it's really important. We do worry about overturning Roe, but there are ways to leave that decision standing that would do as much damage, similar to what's happened to the Voting Rights Act, if you guys have covered that topic on this show. So some of those would go straight at Roe. Some of them would just hollow it out to the point that it was non-existent. And then in 2019, we're actually looking at the Ohio state law that bans abortion at 6 weeks before many women know that they're pregnant being the one that would, and the legislators at the time, let's be clear, said that law was designed to take a run at Roe, and best guess is that that would come before the court in 2019. Mm. It's interesting timing because we think, you know, we do live in a country where the vast majority of people believe in legal access to abortion, believe in the freedom of individuals and families to make their own personal decisions without government interference. And some of these Republicans that might really want to sort of default to serving Mitch McConnell and this president are going to have a lot to answer for in 2020 once this court has started to rule and they cast the vote to put this guy on the court who will be deciding, will be the decisive vote. So you look at someone like Cory Gardner in Colorado, one of the most pro-choice states in the nation. He's up in 2020. He's going to have a lot to answer for, and he needs to think about that really carefully right now.
Well, that raises an interesting kind of electoral power question, which is it's one thing to have voters agreeing with you, and it's another thing to have voters voting on the basis of that agreement. It's very clear that even when anti-abortion forces are in a minority, it is the one issue that gets a lot of them, a lot of the Christian right, to the polls. There's other issues like the environment where people might be pro-environment but vote for an anti-environment candidate because they're saying something they like about trade or immigration. Where does abortion rank or pro-choice sentiment rank among the hierarchy of voter concerns?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, one of the things that I think we all have to wrap our heads around is people often don't vote on issues. People vote for people. And I think we've seen that play out time and time again where you look at exit polls where people are like, oh, yeah, I'm totally pro-environment and I'm pro-reproductive rights and I'm pro X, Y, and Z. And yet I voted for the guy that didn't do any of that. Right. We saw that in a couple of states in 2016 where voters on the ballot affirmed things like, you know, $15 minimum wage and then elected a slate of candidates hostile to $15 minimum wage. So, you know, we as a country have to actually understand that voting is often not a rational decision. But I think what we're seeing now, first of all, I want to go back to my point, which is they mobilize their anti-choice base. It's kind of all that they have left. I mean, I always say, if you look at that sort of unswayable core of Trump support, it's made up of anti-choice infrastructure extremists who have long been the sort of rank and file and boots on the ground of the Republican Party, and in fact, some would argue have a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. We don't have any pro-choice Republicans left, save Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who, you know, have gone both ways, quite honestly, when they're voting for things, and have a very important choice in front of them. But you've got those folks, you've got the white nationalists who have come to the forefront with Trump's presidency, and then you've got this sort of emerging group of what we call men's rights advocates who are just straight up misogynists, and that's who they are. But they are still a minority portion of the population. What we have seen since the election in 2016 is issues that sort of felt like they don't have to be voting issues because they're theoretical, they're not the things that actually affect my family every day, are all of a sudden top of mind for people. So if you look at Priorities USA did a poll not that long ago, and what they found is for women drop-off voters, which means women who are used to voting in presidential elections but often don't come out for midterms, the things that are driving them to the polls right now are abortion rights, women's rights, and health care. Those are exactly the things that are on the line with the Supreme Court pick, exactly to achieve the things that are on the line for the Supreme Court pick. We also are seeing this, I have the privilege of traveling all over the country, and we're seeing this play out in campaigns. So you've got a woman named Kelda Royce running in a very crowded Democratic primary right now for the nomination, the Democratic Party nomination, to take on Scott Walker in Wisconsin in November and potentially unseat him, which would make everyone happy. And one of the things that has allowed her to emerge from this crowded pack, and in fact, one of her opponents in the Democratic primary, who was a self-funder, dropped out a couple weeks ago and backed Kelda because they are seeing what we know to be true, which is women are the ones that are supercharged right now. It is around these issues. And, you know, Kelda knows these issues inside and out. She knows how hostile her state is and how scary the environment would be for women. It already is, but once Roe is gone, and she proactively promised on the campaign trail to pardon women who would immediately become criminals under Wisconsin state law for having abortions. We're seeing Gina Raimondo in Rhode Island call a special legislative session to try and get abortion protection codified on the books, because that's what people are demanding right now. That's the level of anxiety. So I think we have to throw out everything we think we know, the conventional wisdom about what drives people to vote, what drives people to act. It's a new day, and women understand that better than anyone else.
So Elise Hoge is the president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America, joining us from Washington, D.C. Elise, can you talk more about the potential among pro-choice senators for deciding this isn't worth the risk for them politically to vote for this Trump nominee for a Supreme Court justice?
It isn't worth the risk. Are you talking about senators who might split from the party and vote to confirm? I just didn't understand.
I'm sorry. Senators who might split from the Republican Party and vote in opposition to Trump's nominee.
Got it. Yeah, I appreciate that. Look, I mean, we think the choice is clear. They can either cast a vote that would not only be popular from a perspective of women's rights, popular from a perspective of health care, which is hugely popular in these Republican states, popular from a perspective of most of the public, even those who support this president, believe that there should be judicial independence. And what has emerged is that Brett Kavanaugh would not provide that assurance. They can do the right thing and stand up to Mitch McConnell, who I know they're afraid of, and stand up to this president and know that they're afraid of, but it's the right thing by their constituents, and it's certainly the right thing in terms of popularity of the issues. Or they can face voters at the ballot box. Voters are not going to have, like, you know, people depend on, or I'm sorry, I should say operatives, right? Mitch McConnell and the GOP operatives, they're depending on Americans to have a very short memory. The thing that they're not actually thinking about, and I have no idea why, is that we're going to be reminded every day of this vote for or against Brett Kavanaugh, because this court is going to be ruling every single day with or without Brett Kavanaugh on the bench. And voters are going to start to feel almost immediately the impact of this pick on their lives, whether it's through access to reproductive freedom or health care or access to the polling place through voting rights or, deregulation of clean water that, you know, like, people don't want their lives to look like Flint. Flint doesn't want their lives to look like Flint. So this is not going to fade. If you're up in 2018, you're going to feel the wrath because the vote will have just happened. If you're up in 2020, people are going to know every single day what you voted for. So I think, of course, we're looking at the two women who have broken from their party on things like Roe and healthcare in the past. But I think we have to expand it. And that's why this week we didn't just stop in Alaska and Maine in terms of advertising what's at stake. We're in Nevada. We're in Colorado, and we're even in my home state of Texas, because we do think these folks are vulnerable on this vote.
Do you think part of the desire, part of the goal of nominating Kavanaugh is to mobilize that base of Trump supporters, conservatives who oppose a woman's right to choose? And, you know, how successful do you see that attempt to get those folks motivated for the midterms when what's really been happening so far is the opposition to Trump mobilizing much larger numbers, as you just described?
I mean, I think this is, you know, like the cruelty of the family separation work. And by the way, it's not lost on anyone that this administration, who would actually keep a young woman jailed, as we talked about in Kavanaugh's dissent, to prevent her from having an abortion, and would do the same for the rest of us given the opportunity to do it, is also ripping children away from their loving parents' arms and letting children's health insurance lapse and taking food out of hungry mouths with SNAP. I mean, this is like the height of pro-life hypocrisy. I don't even know how they can keep a straight face when they call themselves the pro-life party at this point. And none of the quote, 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 pro-life groups have uttered a word about the obscenity happening on the border. So I just want to note that, because I find it personally enraging. I think that they are doing a Hail Mary. I think that the Trump administration and the GOP are extremely worried about November because we've seen so much energy from our side. The, you know, in most states, the Democratic turnout is far outpacing the Republican turnout in primaries. And I think that these are Hail Marys. The immigration policy or cruelty is a Hail Mary, and I think, you know, forcing this vote prior to the midterms is a Hail Mary. And you know, I think that it is both egregious that they're willing to play those political games with people's lives, and I don't think it's going to work. I think that there is no, our side is only getting more and more energized, and they just don't have the numbers. Even if every single one of their people was energized to go out in November, they simply don't have the numbers.
Well, we're going to end it there then. Thanks so much for joining us. Elise Hogue is president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, an organization dedicated to protecting and expanding reproductive rights. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Antonia. Good to talk to you.
You too.
Bye.